And now,
someone by night.
Your Chilpack Hollywood Hour with Dean Haglund and Phil Lairness. Celebrity deaths.
That was, of course, the late Al Jarreau singing the theme song, well, to your Chilpack Hollywood Hour for 1 week. But before that, it was the originally the theme song to the big hit 1980s television series Moonlighting, which brought Sybil Shepherd to television and brought Bruce Willis to the attention of audiences worldwide. More on Bruce Willis later in this show. But, of course, Dean Haglund, we didn't have time to discuss the life and career of Al Jarreau last week. So should we start with that?
Why not?
You are, if nothing, a fan of smooth jazz vocalists.
if nothing is comparable. I'm a little lax on my smooth jazz vocalist knowledge, let's say.
As you should be. Look, he's dead at 76, and he had a big, big career, and we'll talk about it a little bit. But what is interesting to me to discuss when it comes to someone like Al Jarreau is really the age-old question, is commercial success a sign that you lack integrity as an artist, right? We all have faced this. We've all been in part of this conversation. We've wrestled.
I believe La La Land had that as a plot line.
And indeed, the film itself proves that if you have commercial success, you probably have no integrity. As a musical.
Exactly.
Anyway.
But
enough about that mediocrity.
yes.
Al Jarreau, I don't know. I think suffice it to say, no singer of his era found himself at the center of this debate more often than Al Jarreau. He was, on the one hand, the winner of 7 Grammy Awards. Born Alwyn Lopez Jarreau, and he remains the only singer to win Grammys in 3 different vocal categories, pop, R&B, and jazz. After spending the 1970s making records in search of context, he teamed with producer Jay Graydon, who with the release of 1980's This Time, devised a catchy pop-funk light oriented setting for Jarreau's elastic, scat-adept voice. And 3 pop albums in the 80s followed: Breaking Away, Jarreau, and High Crimes. His success was highlighted by the hit single We're In This Love Together from the album Breaking Away, and of course, his performance to the theme that we just played to the hit 80s TV show Moonlighting. And that pretty much cemented that he would spend the rest of his days in the center of a still ongoing argument over whether or not he was a jazz sellout, a maker of pop mush, or a genre-spanning genius of sorts.
Right. Okay. So, good question. Do we argue this now, or has that argument been laid out?
I don't know if either of us were fans enough or aficionados enough of his work to really weigh in where Al Jarreau was concerned. But we're going to talk about movies a little bit later and everything. And I something just comes up for me always, which is Wes Craven was often described as someone, and we talked about this before, he was often described as someone who was too talented to be making horror films and not talented enough to be making any other kind of movies. And I took great offense to this, as I think only Phil Lernis really is allowed to, because I am no apologist for the horror genre. I have historically not been this.
Right.
But making a great horror film takes no less talent or skill or accomplishment than making a great film in any other genre. Right?
Exactly.
It's all really, really hard. So I like to think that there is a parallel in this debate, that the debate is showing an attitude towards certain forms being easier. And I don't care who you are as a singer, you do what you do for the most part because it's easy. I think you do what you do because it is you to do that particular form.
Right. Right. There's something that speaks to you that only that form, that genre, can relay that story that you need to tell.
Yeah.
So it's not necessarily easier or harder. It's that this is the medium, the forum, the thing that is going to come out of you as an artist.
And so maybe in the case of Al Jarreau, what's being expressed is that it was easier for him to cross over into mainstream success than it was for others of his vocal ilk. And perhaps there was a certain resentment about the ease of his transition that was expressed through these kind of debates. Also, you know, honestly, who is anyone to say that a particular artist should only be working in that particular field, right?
Right. I know. So, yeah, when you cross genres, cross mediums, are you going to something easier? Or are you exploring, like, you know, I paint a lot now more than acting. So have I sold out by being a painter?
Oh, yeah. You really sold out by becoming a painter. You went the easy road to financial success and worldwide fame. Oh, my goodness.
Well,
I don't know if you saw.
Considered...
On Valentine's Day, I don't know if you saw how many people sent you Valentines in the form of you and one or more of the other lone gunmen kissing each other. If your Valentine's greetings are any indication, painting is not the easy way to fame. But it also begs the question, Dean, are you a Romo or a no Romo when it comes to the characters of the Lone Gunman?
Well, so no Romo, I can't get over it. Probably why I didn't see any of those Valentines of gunmen kissing each other. Where did they show up? I'm not going to ask.
Yeah, you really don't want to. And honestly, people, stop it. Just stop it. He doesn't need to see these things. He doesn't want to see these things. Though we promise in a future episode we'll talk about whether or not he is Romo or no Romo when it comes to your Chill Pack Hollywood Hour. Anyway, I also think that I would imagine that more people checked out Al Jarreau's jazz music and catalog because of his hits of the 80s than would have otherwise. And I don't know what their reaction was to that, but certainly I bet his popular success did shine a light on his jazz success. And look, the fact that the topic's coming up and people are saying, hey, he wasn't just those hits, he was also these other things over here, is also helpful to keep that music alive, right? So,
Yeah. So that, you know, I don't hold it against anyone who has any success in any art form whatsoever. God knows how they got there. Bless them all.
Well, and we've talked about this, that stardom, which so often is overnight after decades of preparing and working towards it. But it's such a product of luck to a degree, right? The timing of things, it's luck. But to be someone who is recording regardless of the genre for as long as he did can only be because he knew what the hell he was doing.
Right, exactly.
Right.
So a ton of training behind there, and talent and skill, yeah, and craft.
We have celebrated so many actors on this show who worked steadily for 30, 40, 50 years, even longer, without maybe ever having been a household name. And that's okay. It doesn't make them less talented because they never became a household name. It means they never fell into that perfect storm of role, project, marketing budget, notoriety, you know, all those things mm-hmm. that go into cementing some one performance in a in an audience's imagination. But the fact that they continued to work regularly through all those years mean they knew their craft. Means that they were respected by their fellow storytellers and that they could be counted on to deliver time and time again. And that's what you can control, is whether or not you learn your craft.
The end of sentence. Stop recording.
Good night.
Good night. Mic drop. Walk off the stage.
All right. So I want to tell you two different stories. I wasn't going to get into any live events of the week, but we did have a visit from a couple of our friends here in Los Angeles this week when previous Chill Pack Hollywood Hour guests, I don't remember how long ago that was, but Sam Stone, noted author Sam Stone and her author and publisher husband David J. Howe were here in Los Angeles, and we all got together and did a...
That's great.
A joint appearance on Siren FM's Midweek Drive for UK audiences there. And we did it from the foundation office of the Los Angeles Breakfast Club Foundation. So, yes, Sam and David attended a Breakfast Club meeting this past week. And it was great because they knew it was about the Griffith Observatory. Director Krupp from the Griffith Observatory came to speak to the Breakfast Club. And, of course, Griffith Observatory was has long been a part of the L.A. Breakfast Club. In fact, the founding director of the Griffith Observatory was a member of the Los Angeles Breakfast Club. Anyway, they when they were leaving that day and their friend was driving them to drop them off, they went to the Facebook page and they clicked on the event, and the map that they opened up was one to the Griffith Observatory. So their friend dropped them off at 6:45 in the morning to a closed Griffith Observatory high atop the hill, and then he scooted off. So,
oh, no.
Yeah. So as you know, not an easy walk down that hill.
No.
And all the way to the Breakfast Club on Riverside Drive. They were panicked. They could not, up at the observatory, get any internet signal. So they couldn't use an Uber app. So it was a dicey proposition. And I think those of us who've traveled a lot in our lives all have at least one, if not more, stories of cases like this, right? Where we feel absolutely stranded and hopeless. And I kind of want to put together a book, maybe, of road trip guardian angel stories. Because when someone emerges unexpected, some total stranger, to help you get where you need to go, it really does feel like you have a guardian angel in that.
Like
in that
a magical
moment.
Time traveling, yes.
And
that'd be good.
I've had so many experiences like this, but theirs was incredibly special because they found security guards. They told them their circumstance, and the security guard said, "Well, at least we can try to find out where this event is, get you the right address." And they went in and asked, and the person they found who'd been working all night there and was about to leave and go home and get a few hours shut-eye was Director Krupp's personal assistant. And she knew exactly where the director was going to be speaking and drove them to the event.
Ah, how sweet is that? That's a happy ending to that story.
That is what La La Land should have been about. travelers getting lost in this scary, imposing city, and then a guardian angel swooping in to save their vacation.
Well, how weird is it in a city that you're surrounded by 14 million people that there's still places where you can't get an internet signal up in the Hollywood Hills?
Yeah, I don't know what was going on there, but up at the observatory, yeah, it is tough up there. In fact, it may be one of those spots that they dampen it intentionally.
Oh, interesting.
It might interfere with exhibits. It also, you know, it prevents people from shooting and going live on Facebook from the Tesla coils. Oh. Or I don't know what else.
Oh, yeah, of course. Exactly.
But also, they can't put a tower up there, right? I mean, that's in Griffith Park. I think that would violate all sorts of sort of rules and regulations.
Yeah. Absolutely. Now, they're all around the Hollywood sign.
Dean, your ancestors hail in part from Sweden, do they not?
They do indeed. My grandfather was the bon vivant writer for the major daily newspaper in Stockholm, and went by the name of Finn with two N's. Had a well-read column, that fella did.
So I guess, obviously, your thoughts and prayers must especially be going out to all the people of Switzerland in the wake of the horrible, horrible terrorist incident that took place on Friday, according to our President Trump.
Oh, no. Okay. What happened now? Somehow I missed this story.
Sweden, actually.
So it wasn't Switzerland, it was Sweden.
President Trump got the hell out of Dodge and went to what he referred to as a campaign rally this weekend. Yeah, he doesn't realize that he has the job.
Right.
He went to a campaign rally in Melbourne, Florida. And he talked about the important need for his travel ban to keep these dangerous bad hombres out. You know, they're just flooding in these refugees who mean to do us harm. Never mind again that there's never been violence from anyone coming in through the refugee program in this country. But anyway,
hey,
that's a different topic. Fact. It's a different topic altogether. But he was pointing out, you know, look at how bad the situation is for Germany, letting all those refugees in, and Sweden. Sweden, the horrible things that took place there last night because of this. So somebody decided to look at the top news in Sweden and the top news stories, I kid you not, in Sweden for the night of this supposed terrorist attack were a big storm in the north forced a road closure. There was a power outage that caused a delay in the start of a concert. A high-speed motorist was brought to a halt and taken into custody peacefully in Stockholm. Those were the top three news stories for Friday in Sweden.
But
learned something.
The high-speed motorist was an immigrant.
I learned something about Sweden through this story, which was their official national Twitter feed is handled by a different citizen every week.
Absolutely. And they've extended that to a phone number. So you can call just a citizen of Sweden and just, you know, ask about Sweden and talk. And it would just be every day that number is forwarded. So you volunteer and then you put your cell phone number up and then you get a random call from a stranger from around the world who will ask about Sweden, theoretically in English. And then you're the person who will be the representative diplomat for the day for the country. So it's a lovely way for everyone to get to know about Sweden. I recommend you tweet or give that number a call.
You know, the poor woman, the librarian, the school librarian who's handling the Twitter, she was just deluged because of this. And so she had to set the record straight. No, there was nothing wrong. The former, I guess, prime minister of Sweden was a little more succinct in responding to Donald Trump by asking, "What are you smoking?" He literally asked that question. But here's the worst thing. I mean, many people more involved in politics and what this means for our democracy and our union will weigh in on this more. I just think that it's sad because whether it was a mistake, whether it was a lie, whether it was some kind of stunt, alternative facts, whatever, all this conversation and furor now going surrounding Donald Trump making up a Swedish terrorist attack only serves to draw away our attention from where it belongs, which is, of course, on the plight of the survivors of the Bowling Green massacre. So,
right.
So my sadness, knows no bounds. All right, let's talk about some movies, right. Shall we?
Let's talk movies.
I've been thinking about this for a little while now. We live in a time where you almost can't bring up movies without people screaming like, "Don't tell me anything! I don't want to know," right? Or spoiler free, or you know, and I'm realizing that the only movies that get protected by spoiler-free discussions in advance are shitty movies. That if
right.
Go ahead. Sorry.
That have nothing else going for it, so that if you just give away the one thing, there's no reason to see it.
Or plot.
That's the shitty movies.
Yeah, if all they are is plot, and plot is the least of it. Plot doesn't matter. And, you know, so... But the better a movie is, the more likely context will help you appreciate that movie.
Excellent point.
Placing
Art
it
in context.
In a social context, maybe a political context, a geopolitical context, maybe a historic context, a filmmaking context, right?
Right.
As I've pointed out, La La Land is going to be an embarrassment 10 years from now to the Academy. And hopefully it'll be an embarrassment because more and better original musicals will have been made. But this often happens, and it happens again because too many of the people in the industry voting on these things lack context.
Right.
But
I
thought about this when I watched the great Thailand or a film from Thailand, which won Cannes 2 years ago. I finally caught it. It's called Cemetery of Splendor. And it's about a sleeping sickness that is affecting soldiers in the country. And it's a very metaphoric movie, very symbolic movie. Very interesting. I found the characters very, very interesting. And But only upon delving into the military coup that took over Thailand a few years back, did I start to have the basis of knowledge that would allow me to understand the movie.
Yes, because Thailand had quite a civil uprising. I mean, there was protests, there was tear gas, there was right by the major football stadium, if you've been to Bangkok, by the sky train, the elevated train there that goes right by the stadium, there was a massive last-ditch effort of protest, and I'm not sure how violent it got, but there was definitely civil unrest. And a lot of tourists in the middle of that, too. Friends of mine were there at that time.
So I would, this is another, I think, reason to find film critics whose writing you enjoy. Notice I didn't say necessarily whose opinions you agree with. Whose writing you enjoy. Who, in reading them, you are delighted and you learn something from them. Find these sources. You may already have them when it comes to music. I know I do. But again, something about movies we get so crazy about. Oh, I don't want to have the plot spoiled. For the most part, really good critics are pretty good about not spoiling things, but rather setting a context for your appreciation of them and for further thought. Cemetery of Splendor is a movie that did nothing in America and yet was really well received through so many parts of the world where they are actually educated about what's going on elsewhere in the world. So they had the context, not only the context of what's going on in that country where the movie's set, but also the context of that filmmaker's career. And these things really matter and can really improve your enjoyment. Otherwise, again, you are going to be denied the best films.
That's true.
Because they require this. I needed to immerse myself in the context of so many art forms when I was appreciating the great filmic masters from around the world of the 60s, right? You can't appreciate a Fellini film. You can't appreciate a Godard film if you do not immerse yourself in a context of fine art, of philosophy,
right,
of political thought, of psychology. You just can't. And
60s social uprising everywhere.
Sure.
Too, right? I mean, it wasn't just in America. There, in France, the May uprising, all over the world, that was going on and reflected in films globally.
And no film or work of art exists in a vacuum at all. And the better you can understand the context, often going in, the more you can appreciate it and enjoy the experience, even if the film may not be something that is your particular taste at that point.
Right.
But you won't have an experience that's a waste of time at all. You'll have something that will expand your particular container and give you something to think about. So I urge people to really find those sources that put these works into a context and seek them out. I found that I had to, after the fact, be the source of context for M. Night Shyamalan's new movie, his biggest hit in ages, Split, starring James McAvoy. I got a great letter from someone who had seen it before I had,
yeah,
about how it was a great premise, but really 23 or 24 personalities is just way too many. They should have stuck to 3 or 4. I don't know what movie this guy saw, but only 6 are ever depicted. Now, Shyamalan had a hit recently with something called The Visit. And so I think, yep, it was on the strength of that he gets this film off the ground, Split. And it's surprised everybody by what a big hit it is.
Uh-huh.
And surprised people even more that it turns out it's a sequel to Unbreakable, the Bruce Willis film from 2000, right?
And nobody realized that?
Well, in advance, they apparently didn't. And one of the reasons they didn't was because he was never going to get a sequel to Unbreakable off the ground. You know, it was a hit, but it wasn't enough of a hit to make it a sure thing. And then his career trajectory went into such a downward spiral that he just couldn't get an Unbreakable sequel going. So it's fascinating because here's a movie where apparently people have enjoyed it, but if you don't have the context of Unbreakable, you're not going to enjoy it nearly as much, and you're going to be coming up to me afterwards asking, why the hell was Bruce Willis in that movie?
And, not knowing.
And so now it comes out that Shyamalan has written the treatment, the outline, for part 3 of this trilogy. That the first two were both origin stories. The first one was the origin story of a superhero. Though if you remember, one of the reasons Unbreakable didn't do so well was people didn't know it was a superhero movie until the very end of the movie. And it was a comic book origin story. That was what the movie was about, and that's indeed what it was. But in this effort to keep so much of it secret, they denied context, and that denied context really bothered a lot of people. So it wasn't the hit that I thought the merits of the film warranted, talking about Unbreakable.
No.
I still think that that's Shyamalan's best feature. And this one is fascinating because the first half of the movie, you think, oh, this movie really gets it. This whole thing about personality disorders and split personalities, it really gets it. And it's really on to some fascinating stuff. And then suddenly it starts exploiting those topics. It becomes a smart movie that nevertheless descends into exploitation to give red meat to his core audience. And just at the point that I'm willing to say, fuck this movie, fuck Shyamalan forever and ever, then and only then am I reminded of the advice that was given me, remember Unbreakable. And it turns out, again, like I said, this is the second part of a trilogy. So does it still use these issues that maybe are a little bit uncomfortable to have exploited? Yes, but when you realize it's a comic book movie, somehow that shifts kind of everything. So you're seeing the birth of a superhero in Unbreakable. You're seeing the birth of a supervillain in this one, and... indeed,
theoretically, they meet.
The end of the movie is setting up that, yes, they will meet.
Right.
So it's fun and interesting, the movie, if in an awful way.
Oh, well, that is great praise, I guess. So maybe I should just wait for the third one and then just binge watch all three of them together. Wouldn't that be fun?
Yeah, because binge watching really helps delve into context. But M. Night Shyamalan is interesting to discuss vis-a-vis context, because this is a guy whose career got made on the strength of these twist endings, these surprise
right.
endings. And so much had to be kept secret. And yet, To call Sixth Sense and Unbreakable movies that are all about the twists is to deny the fact that they hold up very well upon repeat viewings. So clearly they're about much more than their twist endings.
That's true, right? Because you watch Sixth Sense now, and even though you know, it's still entertaining filmmaking.
Yeah, and I still find the mother-son story especially moving and compelling. So it still boils down to storytelling. It still boils down to character and place and, you know, interesting experiences, getting to see how characters, hopefully we've never seen before, engage in the world in their own unique way. And he was very good at that for a while. And I almost feel like he became a prisoner, a Shyamalan, of his own success and had to start reverse engineering all these stories based on their twist endings.
Right.
And I don't think context hurts to know that, certainly.
That's not spoiler.
No, but I also don't think saying that this is set in the universe of Unbreakable is a spoiler. I don't think telling someone you might want to go and see Unbreakable before seeing this is a spoiler, because it's a whole different set of characters and story, etc. The equivalent would be going to something called Rogue One and not knowing it's set in the Star Wars universe until you get there.
Right. That would be tough. To not know that.
But the other thing I would like to point out, the context, is how did I become the guy that every stranger comes up to ask questions? I mean,
you do have a podcast for 10 years called Chill Pack Hollywood Hour.
You think everyone knows that? You think that the people at the Hollywood Bowl who came up to me to ask, to demand why Hall & Oates didn't sing She's Gone or Rich Girl, you think that it's because of my podcast they knew?
Yeah, you're a purveyor of popular culture, and everyone's well aware of your Hall & Oates love. So,
still one of my favorite, experiences to have all these people come up and me to say to them, "Well, you're certainly asking the right guy," and then and then they said, "Really?" And I got to say,
really?
"No, I'm flattered that you thought of me, but I'm not the one to call."
So you don't know why they didn't sing that.
So from a film split, which is fun and interesting in an awful way,
right,
to Passengers, a big budget sci-fi romance that was released at the holidays that is awful in an albeit fun and interesting way.
Oh, that's fascinating.
This is a movie that gets everything wrong. I mean, it's an interesting concept about interstellar travel to other worlds in a future where the Earth has habitated other homestead planets that are hundreds of years away, even at light speed travel. And so the people who are going to go colonize those worlds have to go in hibernation. And by the time they wake up and arrive, obviously everyone and everything they knew back at home is long since gone. And this film Passengers is about one such cruise. The ship is entirely on autopilot, and one pod suddenly awakes its inhabitant, a passenger played by Chris Pratt. And the first act is him kind of losing his mind in isolation on that ship, and then he decides
silent running,
and he decides to awaken a second person after much debate and internal wrestling, wakes a second passenger so that he's not alone. And the passenger is played by Jennifer Lawrence. And then the whole second act is them learning to fall in love and build a life together alone on the Ark until such time as she finds out what he did. Okay. And then the third act introduces really the plot of the film, which is what they have to solve together. And the reason I give that much away is there's a whole act in there that isn't needed, which is the first act, which is Chris Pratt's character waking up and being alone and figuring all these things out, especially for a movie that is starring Jennifer Lawrence. She's she's top billed. Well, if
and
you're going
to show up,
she's asleep. She's Sleeping Beauty for the first act. But if you're going to say starring Jennifer Lawrence, then here's a thought. Have it star Jennifer Lawrence. And it is actually a much more interesting beginning to a story to have her awaken, to have her have the same experience Chris Pratt did, which is, okay, we must be arriving. Wait, what do you mean we're still 97 years away? Wait, why did my pod awaken me? Wait, why am I the only person on this ship? Have her go through all that experience, and then all of a sudden, she comes across Chris Pratt, who is surprised to see her. And he said, oh, yeah, the same thing happened to me like a year ago. And then they fall in love and then they do it and all this. And then you find out that he brought her out of hibernation. Because the way that they've set it up, we know that he does it. So the whole middle third of the movie, the whole middle 45 minutes is just us waiting for the other shoe to drop.
Well, that's miserable.
Yeah.
Whose idea was that?
Instead of tying with her point of view and experiencing things as she experiences it, which is good storytelling.
Right. Isn't that like what they would teach you in a Sid Field's screenwriting class, basically?
I guess. I don't know if anybody's taking screenwriting classes anymore. I also have a lot of problem with the third act, where they also get everything wrong, but that would be a spoiler, so I will not. I will not reveal.
They got
that.
Everything wrong,
but you know, but it is one of those movies where I was really looking forward to seeing it because you know it's a big space adventure, but but boy, they manage to get everything wrong.
They screwed up.
And speaking of getting everything wrong, the last film that I wanted to touch on. The last film I wanted to touch on was the third and what doubtless will be the final Dan Brown big screen adaptation, at least by Ron Howard and Tom Hanks. And thank goodness, we all love the T. Hanks, but to see him running around in loafers and a sport coat, I mean, it just, I kept wanting them to call cut so that we could check Tom Hanks' blood pressure. He's shuffling around. Just sign the papers, Tom. Sign the papers.
Oh my God!
It's so sad.
Is the coat a little tight? Is that the blood pressure worry?
He's just too old. He is too old to be playing that character anymore. And you know, it's interesting because you read the press materials for Inferno. That's the film I'm talking about. It did nothing,
of course,
at the box office anywhere in the world. And the first two were big hits. Obviously, Angels and Demons, not the big hit that Da Vinci Code was, but it was still a big hit and a better movie than Da Vinci Code. This, I love in the press notes, it says loosely adapted from the novel by Dan Brown. And the one thing that's interesting about watching the movie is you can actually tell while watching it that the book must be more interesting.
Oh, no.
And
they adapted the interesting parts out?
Kind of, yeah. To try to make it a more broad, wider box office appeal. And lo and behold, that doesn't work.
Right.
But I, you know, what's interesting is, to me, the idea that somebody might want to go back to these Robert Langdon novels and might want to serialize them as like a TNT series, something like what Suzanne Bier did with Jean Le Carré's The Night Manager. Turn each of these books into that. And then you could really get into these mysteries. And on television, you could really embrace what, let's face it, is the most fun of these kind of books, which is people just sitting and talking.
Historical context, too. I mean, that's the thing.
Yeah.
You brush over, you know, ancient Catholic rites and bizarre St. Francis of Assisi minuscule laws and stuff like that. Like all the stuff that Dan Brown researched the hell out of that went into these things are so blown over on all of these movie adaptations because it's just high speed running and chasing and guns. And it's like, wait, hold it. What is this one thing that you seem to have a ton of knowledge about that was one sentence in the screenplay?
Well,
I want more exploration than that.
Exactly, because, you know, I think we're finding it's a particular kind of book where it is more naturally suited to an episodic treatment than to a film treatment because of exactly what you said. The movie in 2 hours has to be on the run. It has to be on the move. The book is, I mean, the reason those books are so popular is that there's these page turners that are on the run, that are on the move. However, they do get to embrace the reality, which is, oh my God, we have to rush from Venice to Istanbul. We've got to get to Istanbul as fast as we can. Well, that still takes hours. Even even if you get the first plane out, it's still going to be hours before you're there. You still get to sit on the plane and have hours-long conversations about what's going on. So there's this combination in the books of it is a page-turner. They are always on the run, but within the context of being on the run are all those hours of conversation that you have to cut out of a movie. But those conversations in between being on the run are where the real gems of the Robert Langdon world reside, where the real joy in these books can be derived. So it seems to me that a mini-series adaptation of these books was really the way to go.
And I think we're at the crossroads right now where I think the next generation of studio guys are going to realize, you know, stuff like Cloud Atlas, like the Dan Brown novels, like all of these things that have massive popularity, Cloud Atlas, whatever, but that the hierarchy is not, if it's super popular, we make it a studio film. That hierarchy is going to change and that it's now going to find the medium that best suits the material, a la a Netflix or a primetime serialized Amazon Prime, you know, a serialized thing that you can binge watch as much as you want. That would be encapsulated in 1 hour or 45 minute chunks. And then that way that's better serving the material than just cramming it into a 2 hour movie. And 2 hour movies that maybe before would have been dumped as a mini series TV movie of the week, then gets elevated to a studio film where you get to explore character and relationships that sort of thing.
You have just explained the most beautiful, not only segue into the topic I wanted to discuss, but you've basically expressed one of the major themes of it, which is we are living in this TV bubble right now that some people are starting to say is going to burst. And my end to this, in finding this interesting, was how often I hear that movies used to be the shapers of consciousness culturally, but now it's TV because TV is so good and there's so much good TV. And how this opportunity for TV arose was because movies just got bigger, louder, more expensive, which priced so many really talented people, actors, writers, producers, directors, out of movies. They couldn't find a living anymore because it was only the biggest stars and the directors who could do the biggest action and the editors who could handle the biggest action, right? And all these great storytellers then moved to TV. So suddenly working on smaller budgets but longer form scales, you have an extraordinary amount of talent developing an unprecedented amount of great episodic television. And we're reaching the point where we can't have any more good TV because we already can't keep up. Used to be it wasn't that long ago where the only time you had a conflict in terms of not being able to keep up with good TV was if two good shows were opposite each other and you couldn't figure out how to program your VCR. That was the only way that you were ever missing out on good TV. And now, even if you watch it a lot, even if you are a purveyor of pop culture who has a 10-year-running podcast, you're still missing a lot of great television because there's so much of it. And at some point, and we're getting there, the question becomes, is it great TV if there's no audience around to watch it? Because these audience sizes are getting smaller and smaller and smaller.
However, your shelf life is longer and longer of how long these things can stay in the queue on the thing. So, you know, for instance, Ascension, which is a sci-fi series on my Netflix that I haven't seen any marketing for, I stumbled on. Jill Bellows from Vancouver, great lead in this thing. Spectacular premise. Well done. I love this thing, and I watched the whole thing in like a day and a half.
But you're leading me back to my point, though, that this is cyclical, and movies are going to be the main shaker in the not too distant future if they change their paradigm. Because the only outlet that seems to be able to afford that unlimited shelf life is Netflix. You're right about that. They need more and more episodic content. They can drop as many as they want every month. They have unlimited bandwidth and unlimited content that they need to fill. But producing that content is so expensive for most cable networks, which are really the ones doing so much of the good shows right now. It's so expensive. And their viewership numbers are getting smaller and smaller because every cable network is creating good shows, that more and more of their hours of programming each week are dedicated to what? To airing movies, not to airing television. So you're going to see it rebound. And if the movie industry can think along the ways you were describing earlier, which is don't think about what's the big novel. Okay, the big novel that's hugely popular, of course that's a movie. Don't think about it like that. Right. Think about all the talented storytellers who are making great content on television now, and what if we gave them modest-sized film budgets and we made fewer $200 million films, $100 million films. Because when we make those movies, we have to make sure that they play in enough theaters out of the gate to ensure our investment enough. And if you made fewer films of that budget level and more films of a smaller budget level, you could then place them into fewer theaters where they could stay for a much longer period of time. And therefore what? Therefore have a chance to really attract an audience and to move the cultural conversation, which, let's face it, is how films did it. Movies never had as many people watching them as watched television shows. Never. You know, there might be one film, two films a year that had an audience equal to that of a big hit TV series. And yet for 50 years, it was movies that had a cultural impact, not television, which was far more popular. It really did get to do with quality. And that quality is there. And let's face it, so many of these television shows that we're enjoying are being made by people that we have no doubt could use the larger canvas of a big screen to excellent effect. These people are the real deal, and they could tell a two-hour story that would knock our socks off. So,
true.
So
but
I think
two
the
things have to happen for that model to go.
Right.
And the first thing is your risk management assessment algorithm that's in place right now that comes from Harvard Business School that determines the risk and outlay of financial and other capital to returns. That algorithm has to change. And B, the contract between studios and exhibitors with the 90-10 split first week, 80-20 split second week, that has to change so that the longer the shelf life, it's still profitable for the studios and not the exhibitors.
Yeah.
So I agree that movie's sitting a longer time to find the audience, to have legs, as it were, a la Big Fat Greek Wedding, Devil Wears Prada, a variety of movies that took a while to find an audience and word of mouth to get out there. Also, didn't show big money up front, which again comes back to your risk management assessment algorithm that you place on every artistic thing in the first place, which is why are you doing that anyway?
I might argue, and this opens up a can of worms, but perhaps all the protections against vertical integration where theaters are concerned ought to be stripped away. Because after all, it's been stripped away in every other way. We're dealing with communications monopolies. Why not let these studios have their own theater chains?
I mean, that was the worry in the 20s and the 30s of monopolization. But it's
a monopoly in all other ways. All the talent is negotiating against the same people who own the same studios. You know, it's like five companies own every communications. So anyway, that could change things too. But the point is, I mean, I think this is cyclical, and I think we are at the point where it is possible, to get back to your point, that a handful of years from now, something like the Robert Langdon movies, the knee-jerk will not be, this needs to be a big-budget movie with the biggest movie star and the biggest director. No, this absolutely needs to be episodic.
Right.
Because it's not a two-hour story. What's a two-hour story? What is, because people love two-hour stories. Why do they love them? They love them because they know that they can finish them.
Exactly. There's an end to it. I know. And not leave it for a sequel, not leave you hanging. But I even think of Cloud Atlas, like how much information was on a multi-generational, multi-story, time-traveling, reincarnation epic that they tried to cram, and it came into like 2 hours and 34 minutes. And even then, it felt overbearing and way too long. You know, that it would have been so much better to concentrate. Anyway,
well,
I loved Cloud Atlas as a book, but the movie totally disserviced it and in such a big way.
Well, I think it's fair to say you loved Cloud Atlas, the movie, while knowing that it didn't always or often work the way that you wanted
it
to.
Yes, exactly.
But it's hard not to love that movie, you know, to have a genuine affection for it. And we've talked about this before.
Yeah.
We don't love something because of how good it is, right? I mean, we love it because of how it makes us feel. We love it because of what it's attempting. We love, you know, all these things. And I just feel like Cloud Atlas is the sort of movie that desperately needed those of us who liked what it was trying to do to harbor deep affection for it, because it was, if the words noble failure mean anything, it applies to that film. there's great nobility in their failure. I thought it was interesting that, you know, we are going to have the Oscars next week, and one of the big Oscar winners of the 80s, Out of Africa, which told the story of author Isaac Dinesen, right? It is getting remade, and it's getting remade by Oscar-winning director Susan Bier, who won an Academy Award for After the Wedding, and who directed the John le Carré adaptation for TNT, The Night Manager. And she is turning it into a miniseries.
Ah, see?
Which befits its literary roots, right?
Right.
And, you know, I get down on these remakes so often and these, you know, reboots and things like that. But here's another one that feels right to me, that feels interesting. And that is an adaptation of Paddy Chayefsky's 1976 satirical classic, Network. There is going to be a new version of Network. It's going to star Bryan Cranston as Howard Beale, the role that won Peter Finch's posthumous Oscar. And where is it going to be? Yeah. It's going to be set on stage. It's on Broadway. It's a stage adaptation. Doesn't that make sense? Because the parts it eliminates then are the part that go out into the world, which made it a little too much for me, a product of the 70s, and it's those part of the movies that that don't hold up so well. But the part within the newsroom, in the corporate offices of that network, that's every bit as resonant and relevant today as it was, 40 years ago. So...
40 years ago.
But I really think also that if this happened and these changes in the paradigm that you described and that I've described, if those came about, I got to believe we would see fewer of these just needless remakes. I mean, I was struck as I was driving home the other day from the Breakfast Club, and I passed a sign pointing into Griffith Park indicating that the new remake of the Steve McQueen classic Bullet was shooting up in Griffith Park. And and honestly, I hope that that movie will introduce Steve McQueen to a new generation. But if it doesn't, what's the point? That's the only reason to remake Bullet is to introduce Steve McQueen to a new generation.
I smell a car dealer, a car manufacturer behind this, because it also sold that really cool Mustang he was driving. I assume that they're going to have the cool.
This is the thing that I'm curious about, though. I think Brad Pitt is starring, and you go, okay, well, I mean, that's as big of a movie star as you're going to get. That makes sense, right?
Yeah.
Who are you going to replace Steve McQueen with? I guess Brad Pitt. But don't you... I don't know. I just sometimes think, you know, Pierce Brosnan remade Thomas Crown Affair, and people enjoyed that at the time, though it's hard to watch now. But but... I kind of want to just ask these guys. I've enjoyed Brad Pitt in movies. I, of course, have enjoyed Pierce Brosnan. And I just sometimes want to ask them, do you ever think about whether or not any of your movies might be remade someday? Because because while you're so busy remaking other people's, how about making some that might stand the test of time on their own so that future generations want to pee all over them? I don't know. I just think it's strange. Like, why do you need to do that? How is that keeping you relevant, updating a previous star's work? It just seems a little...
I don't know if they think that far ahead. I'm sure there's money tossed at them. You're remaking something again. We talked before how this simplifies marketing. It's like, oh, remember that movie? Well, this is the updated version. Here it is. And we don't have to advertise that much because we just point to that other movie that you like. So it's a paycheck, and it's mitigating your costs because you use your risk assessment algorithm all over these art projects. So
do you remember? Do you remember what has been called in the articles I've been reading? What is it? Iconic comedy of the late 1970s, Every Which Way But Loose.
Did they call it an iconic comedy?
Well, now they're calling it that. They're calling it iconic because they can't get away with calling it classic or good. But it is iconic in that uh, it it probably is the biggest musical hit of Clint Eastwood's career, right? When he sang Every Which Way But Loose. Anyway.
Oh, that's right.
I should close the show with that. Oh my God. Anyway, they're remaking it, and I guess it's the guy who directed the original is producing the remake. So I don't know. Maybe he needs the money, and God bless him. But if you don't have Clint Eastwood, why would you?
Right.
I guess last week I talked about John Wick 2 a lot, and I pointed out how Keanu Reeves might be the closest thing to a present day, contemporary
Eastwood.
Clint Eastwood, in terms of,
yeah.
you know, him eschewing dialogue and playing a certain kind of toughness on screen. So maybe you get Keanu Reeves, but God bless Keanu Reeves. He's actually, you know, building a very interesting career arc for himself these days. I mean, at the same time mm-hmm. that John Wick 2 probably has all these action franchises dropping money at his door, he just makes a huge splash at Sundance by being one of the stars of a drama To the Bone, which Netflix paid a huge amount of money for. It's written by and directed by Marty Noxon, who did Unreal and The Girlfriend's Guide to Divorce. And it's based on her own experiences living with an eating disorder. And the movie stars Lily Collins, basically as her, a woman who checks into an unconventional program to help with her battle over severe anorexia. And this film co-stars Keanu Reeves. This is what he's doing in addition to his John Wick 2s. So, you know, good for that guy for carving
Absolutely.
Out his own path, huh?
Well, absolutely. And you think about his lifestyle as well. I mean, he doesn't own a house. He stays in hotels.
I love that.
Basically,
I love
that. Yeah. That he either just has a hotel or lets the production pay for a hotel. So he is unrooted to materialism like no other actor or person I have ever heard of. From what I understand, like his wardrobe fits in a suitcase, all his world belonging fits in a suitcase, and I think he drives a late model Porsche. That's his one thing, and the rest of it, a lot to charity, from what I hear, and that he picks projects that resonate somewhere with his own particular chord. So you know, you got to hand it to that guy. He's not listening to strategic managers or agents that are telling him, you got to take this to get that, and we got to build you up to this so that you're making this many digits by this year. You know, he's not in on those meetings, or he's refused to take those meetings. And I say good on him. I can't wait now that he's at this age where he'll really gravitate to, When you're looking back over your life and what it means to be an artist, what projects he will come up with.
Well, that brings us to an end of what turned out to be a very interesting episode of your Chill Pack Hollywood Hour. You can find every episode at chillpackhollywood.com. Please write us, chillpackhollywood @yahoo.com.
Mm-hmm. And you can see us on Facebook. We're at facebook.com/chillpackhollywood. Like us, poke us, do all those things that you do on Facebook.
Follow us on Twitter and Instagram.
At the same handle. We're at Dean and Phil. Spell out the word and.
Hashtag we give good hashtag.
Yes.
We'll be back with a special installment of your Chill Pack Hollywood Hour next week. Until then, I'm Phil Lairness.
Ooh. I'm Dean Haglund. See you then.
Oh, and it's Eddie Rabbit, not Clint Eastwood, who sings the theme from Every Which Way But Loose. Nevertheless, here you go.
If I'm headed for a heartache, then why the hell am I still here? I'm testing my resistance, and it's wearing mighty thin.
Promotional consideration paid for by Empire State Gas. From farm to pump, we've got great gas.
My mind tells me to move along, but my body begs me stay. And now I feel the need to hold you close and love the night away while you're turning me every which way but loose.
way but lose. Inside the fire's burning me. In my mind you just keep turning me. Every which way but lose. Baby, there's no excuse to turn me. Every which way but lose.
Belated spoiler alert.